So how you doing, Law?
I'm doing good. I actually poked a hole through the duct tape in the window here, and I'm having a beautiful summer breeze blow through.
It is
It's
a
so
beautiful
nice
day.
after being freezing all winter.
Maybe we should think about moving to Florida for the winter. What do you think?
Sure,
Do you
let's
need
just move to
money?
Florida. Maybe we could sell this house and make about 25 bucks, and that'd get us to Troy, and we could hitchhike the rest of the way to Florida.
Well, I guess we best get started then. Anyway, welcome
All
everybody to
right.
episode 2 of season 3 of the Half Alive podcast.
We are the Law and Law Brothers. My name is Law, a 60-year-old twin.
And my name is Law, his 60-year-old twin.
Our podcast is for people like us, people in the arts who tried and failed to make a living doing what we love. Me as an actor in LA, and my brother as a writer in New York City.
Now we live in a condemned and forgotten house in Schenectady, New York, with an ancient furnace and no AC.
And we're spiraling into financial ruin, but somehow we're still pursuing our craft.
Just with different outcome expectations than when we were young. A different definition of success, you could say. Each week, we discuss something we've learned from the various sources about carrying on, no matter the roadblocks.
And sometimes we have guests who inspire us with their stories of redefining their meaning of success. So, with all that said, we have a guest today
We
who is
do
going to save
indeed.
our lives and yours.
We do indeed. We have a writer and mental health advocate and self-defense coach from New York City, Julio Rivera, who has lived with bipolar disorder, CPTSD, which I had to look up, complex post-traumatic stress disorder, and ADHD. Decades of training has shaped his philosophy, but just as important has been Julio's experience with trauma recovery, mindset, and emotional regulation. He's also a martial arts instructor and passionate about empowering people because of his own experiences with mental illness and trauma. His first book, Broke Down Sensei: How I Forgot About Trauma and Bipolar Disorder from the Outside In, is on Amazon. And his next book, Internal Jiu-Jitsu, I knew I was going to screw that up. Jiu-Jitsu, How to Conquer Inner and Outer Resistance by Giving Way, will be published in May, Mental Health Awareness Month, by White Deer Publishing. He's also a graduate of NYU's journalism program, and we are absolutely delighted not only to have a guest who didn't die or wind up in prison like our previous ones, but we are delighted to have a guest today,
Or
Mr.
didn't kill
Julio
anyone.
Rivera, who didn't kill anybody, our guest, Mr. Julio Rivera. So, welcome, Julio.
Glad. I've had my fair share of failure as a writer and as an actor, so I'm kind of a mixture of both you guys. Well, you're actually at the point where we were when we actually gave up. You have success now, but we were about your age when we actually threw in the towel and then went to sleep in me in the basement, lying in the attic for 15 years till we finally woke up. So you are gonna ins your story is inspiring alone.
Okay, La, so should we maybe let Julio
Thank
do
you.
some talking?
That's yeah, I mean, it's
You
funny
think
you say
he's...
that because jiu-jitsu is all about using what you're given, you know, and that's I think that's what I've done. I mean, I've kind of been cursed with these disorders, but at the same time, I use them to kind of I use them for my art, you know, and it's been the greatest therapy that I could have.
Interesting. So, Julio, can you tell us about these disorders for those? I mean, I think most of us have a basic idea of what they are, but not really detailed symptoms,
Sure.
things like that.
I have what's called bipolar 2. So it's a little different from bipolar 1. Instead of mania, it's what's called hypomania. So it can last a little bit shorter than mania. It's not quite as, well, I was going to say it's not quite as destructive, but that's not true because it ruined my life for a while. But it's slightly different. People with bipolar 1, they'll often go on these super long, super destructive streaks. I have more rapid cycling where I'll be super depressed one day and then super up another day, or I'll have a couple of months where I'm up really high and then a couple of months where I'm super depressed. And thank God I've been stable for the last year. So it's been a different experience, but I've also been flat for the last year because of the stability. So it's been tougher in the last few months to write because the ideas don't flow the same way when you're not symptomatic, you know. It's easy to write when you're depressed. It's easy easy to write when you're hypomanic because you feel connected to everything around you. So you can write about anything. You know, you could write about a flower for pages and pages and pages when you're hypomanic. And when you're depressed, I mean, that's the greatest material you could have to really pour your soul out. So being stable is kind of boring. And as far as the CPTSD goes, that's just from daily trauma, you know, from growing up in a really bad area and seeing tons of violence and witnessing murders and seeing people get mugged and being mugged at gunpoint myself, and just always being tense and believing that something was about to go down. And when you do that every day and the stress hormones are released, you know, you develop these issues where the slightest trigger can make you feel like you're back in that place. So up until my 40s, I would get these attacks, these flashbacks where I felt like I was in danger, and I would scramble to try to get away. I mean, I'd look everywhere, my eyes would dart around, and I would look for escape, even if I was silent, you know. Sometimes it would happen out in public, and I'd have to try to keep it quiet to myself. So that was probably the most disturbing, because it felt like I was running away from a lion when there was nothing chasing me, you know. And then the ADHD, I think people are a little bit more familiar with, but most people have the wrong idea of what it is, you know. Most people think it's a fidgety kid at
Right.
school, but there's so much more that goes behind that. Dopamine levels, and you know, whether or not you can get motivated, because without dopamine, it's really hard to get up for anything, because your sense of reward is really gone. So you can't think about what you're going to get out of something. You can't think very far ahead. So the motivation's really hard to come by. You're tired a lot. It's hard to read. It's hard to study. And for me, actually, when I'm not on my medication, on my ADHD medication, it makes my flashbacks worse. I don't quite know why, but the comorbidity, everything sort of attacks at once, you know. The anxiety takes over, and I start to kind of fall apart a little bit. So when I went off my meds on my own, I discovered that that wasn't a good idea, because I started spiraling. And ever since then, I've been really strict with my protocol, because I know that without it, even if I'm going to feel super good for a while, the eventual crash is going to tear me down, you know. That's what it's like living with the stuff.
And I'm sorry to ask this. Did you find out that you had all three of these about the same time, or is it sort of a gradual diagnosis?
No, I found out about all three at the same time. I was coming off a 2-year depression, and my life seemed perfect on the outside, you know. I had a great business, a great wife. I just had a baby. Just bought a new place. I mean, I had it all. But I was super depressed every day. I thought about killing myself, and I couldn't get on in life. And finally, my ex-wife was like, "Listen, you need some help." And I was reluctant because I didn't want to go on medication. But I found this really great psychiatrist. I was very lucky. He wasn't just a pill pusher. He spent an hour with me and pulled out some books and asked me to read and see if anything kind of rang a bell for me. And everything did, you know, and he told me, "Look, this is what I believe that you have, and this is how we're gonna try to treat it." And that day changed my life, you know. The first time I took ADHD medication, it was like my eyes opened for the first time. I couldn't believe that someone could be focused and be able to read a page and remember what they read and simple things like that. So I immediately knew I made the right decision when I took the medication, you know. So
Did it
this
make your earlier life
wow.
start to make sense, like your decisions and before the diet, having a diagnosis? Oh, I
Sorry, I
can't be
lost you
heard.
there.
Can you hear us now?
I am back. I have no idea what happened. I didn't touch anything.
So before you had a diagnosis, because we've never been diagnosed, we've never even, we only deal with our past by sarcasm and avoidance.
And eating.
But I'm curious about you. Once you had a diagnosis, did your life before the diagnosis start to make sense and it was validating and you kind of, oh, now I understand. Now I understand. And how did that must have been a big high all on its own.
Yeah, it felt amazing. I mean, I was a really good student, but I hated school because I hated studying, and I had a hard time with it. And I made a lot of poor decisions when I was hypomanic. I never realized that that was what was going on, but I would go on, spending sprees, and I would just think that everything was going to work out. I would just take risks, believing that everything would be fine because I just had the greatest luck and I was so connected to the universe that there was no chance of me failing. And I made a lot of irrational decisions because of it, despite good advice from my family. Burned through tons of money. And I couldn't understand why I was seemingly so irresponsible, why I couldn't project into the future and kind of see that these negative things were going to lead to bad outcomes later. So once I got diagnosed, it made way more sense to me why someone who I consider myself a rational guy, why I made so many irrational decisions, and why I struggled so much, with some of my relationships, especially my marriage. That really became clear to me. I was super defensive when my ex-wife would say that I needed to see someone or that I might need medication. And she would always say, "Look, it's your trauma. It's your trauma." And I was just like, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about? It's my trauma. This is just the way I am." I was really, I had a very short temper. I had something called, what's it called? Intermittent anger or intermittent explosive disorder. That's what it's called. So you get like these explosive anger, episodes, maybe a couple of times a year. But usually you're super calm and you're chill. So when you get these anger outbursts that are way over the top, people are super freaked out, So I've had that happen a couple of times in my life where people who knew me really well suddenly thought I was the most evil person in the world because I flipped out on them. And a couple of times that happened with my ex-wife, and I didn't understand because to me that's how you expressed anger. That's how I grew up, when you were upset, you yelled. You slammed the door. That's what you did. And my ex-wife wasn't used to that. Her family was super quiet and her family kind of repressed things. So for her, it was a shock when I would raise my voice.
When I would get angry, my ex-wife couldn't hear the words that I was telling her.
Right.
So it was impossible for us to relate because she would only see my emotion. And when she would see anger, she would see a threat. And she would let me know that I was being scary. And I would get super defensive because I knew that I'd never hurt her. And again, it was natural for me to express anger in a big kind of way. And I think that's part of that is because I was the youngest in the family. I was in a scary place. And when I got scared, I made loud noises so that people would kind of stay away from me. I acted kind of nuts so that people would run away. So I think that stayed with me. So when I felt defensive about something, I would explode just to protect myself, even though I never got physically violent with people, I mean, not anyone that didn't deserve it, I definitely scared a lot of people and people that I cared about too, people whose friendship I lost because of those issues with anger, or people that I disrespected. And I would always try to apologize afterwards, and I would always feel really sad and sometimes cry afterward, because I didn't know why I was reacting this way and I knew it was super irrational. And it happened with my family a lot too. So, of course, the last thing I wanted to do was upset them in any way. After the diagnosis, I realized that a lot of those things were out of my control because of the disorders. And ever since then, I get angry very, I mean, almost never. I'm very calm and even tempered. I still get the depression and the anxiety, but I don't get angry. And I don't, sometimes I wonder if the depression took the place of the anger in some ways, whether I change the emotion, so that I stifle the anger. So that's something that I'm on the lookout for, because I know that anything that I repress is going to end up coming out later somehow. So if I'm doing that with anger, then that could lead to a problem down the line, you know. And that's
And
something I wouldn't have thought about before being medicated also.
so you turned it around, and that's the origin story of your books. So can you tell us about that? How you managed to find redemption in exercise, I
Yeah,
guess.
how did you channel, like you went to school for journalism, right? Were you writing all the time, or did you start to use that the writing after you got your diagnosis?
Well, no, I'd been writing since I was 12. I was writing for magazines right out of college for Muscle and Fitness and some other magazines. But I was still competing in bodybuilding at the time, so I was very involved in that. And so I blew opportunities as an actor and as a writer because of my bodybuilding. I was competing on a national level. I was gigantic, and it's a sport that requires a singular focus, and being selfish. And I would turn down things that I was offered because of my bodybuilding, because I was getting ready for a contest like the Mr. USA or the Nationals. So I remember I got an assignment from my editor for Muscle and Fitness, and Muscle and Fitness was the biggest fitness magazine in the world at the time. And I got an assignment, and after a week, I was like, "Look, I can't do this. I'm training for the show, and I just can't do it. I'm too involved with the show." And they never sent me another assignment, you know. And with acting, it was the same. With acting, I was on a TV show from when I was 16 to 20 on PBS that I co-hosted, and from that show, I had a lot of doors open up for me. So I decided to trim down from my big physique and pursue acting for a year to take off from bodybuilding and trim down. And when I did, I got a bunch of meetings with agents and I started getting work. And then I got pulled back by bodybuilding again, and I wanted to do the nationals again, so I got huge again. And then I stopped getting calls from my agents. So it was bodybuilding each time that would kind of pull me away from what I was doing, writing and acting. And it really didn't make sense, because it's the most unhealthy sport, the most unhealthy activity I think that you can engage in, especially at that level, because you have to take a bunch of drugs, and it's not healthy. So I retired when I was 23, thank goodness, because I think it would have led to some health problems. And I have friends from those days that became legends in bodybuilding, but I don't envy them in any way, because I know what they had to go through. I know what they had to put their bodies through. I know how unhealthy it is. So I'm glad I left that life behind when I did. I just got sick of it because I started it so young. I started competing when I was 14 years old in bodybuilding. So, you know,
Wow.
that's kind of unheard of. Had a lot of success early on, but I always wanted to do martial arts, and I was just too big when I was bodybuilding. So when I quit bodybuilding, I jumped into martial arts like full steam when I was 23, and that became my life, you know.
So after your diagnosis, when things started emotionally starting to pull together, how did you use, did the jiu-jitsu complement your recovery, and did you get better at jiu-jitsu? How did it all kind of come together?
So I was dealing with the depression and hypomania throughout my training, and I didn't know what I had. But sometimes I'd walk in to the academy and I would just be like overjoyed. And I remember one day I came in and I gave my coach a big hug, and I was like almost in tears, and I was like, "Thank you." And like, it was just, he was looking at me like I was out of my mind, you know. But I was just feeling like so good and so connected to everybody at the time. And then other days I would just come in super depressed, and anxious, because in jiu-jitsu, you know, you spar every day, live sparring. So, and it's pretty much 100%. So it's, you know, you're going into battle every day. And I would train early in the morning. So, you know, on a cold winter day in New York, to get up at 6:30 and go train it, to be at the academy at 7:30 when you don't really want to go and you're anxious and you're depressed, that really took a lot out of me to like I had to muster up everything that was in me to get out of bed because I'd have to roll out of bed back then. I was in so much physical pain from training that I literally roll out of my bed onto the floor and then stand up from there. I couldn't just get out of the bed.
We do that now for different reasons.
So it was really hard, but it definitely built more discipline. I mean, I got a lot of discipline from bodybuilding, but martial arts brought it to another level. I had to deal with a lot of injuries and fight through the injuries. And I remember I had a test for my one of my brown belts, and I tore a pectoral muscle during the test, and it was like a 3-hour test, and I had to fight the entire school. And halfway through, I tore the muscle, and I just pushed through, and I pushed through, and I pushed through. And even though that was kind of a traumatic experience too, getting beat up by 100 people, it built resilience in me, you know, where I know that no matter how tough something seems, there's always a way out, and there's always a little bit more in you to go a little bit further, you know, even when you think you've given it all you have. Yeah, jiu-jitsu taught me not to quit, but sometimes that you have to surrender, you know. Someone gets you in a submission hold, and you have no choice, and you have to tap. And in life, it's the same way, you know. We try and we try, and sometimes we have to surrender. And surrender is not quitting, you know. There's a difference in my
That's
eyes.
actually the theme of the show, like when to keep fighting, when to quit, how to accept quitting without giving up. You know, that's kind of what we're trying to figure out for ourselves, and hopefully if anybody's listening, for folks in that situation too, you know, who had a dream that you fight for that dream, it doesn't happen. So what do you do? Do you go off, you know, do you end it, or do you find a way to use what was best about that dream and move forward? Or like that's what the show's about. So what you just said was very inspiring.
Can you tell us about your
I mean,
first book?
yeah, my first book is supposed to be what my second book was. So it was probably 5 or 6 years ago. I was hypomanic, and I came into my apartment, and I just had the words internal jiu-jitsu in my head, and I felt like that was what I was doing. Because I was on this internal kick at the time, and really working on myself and doing a lot of meditation, and I felt like I was using the principles that I had learned from my mind. So I came into my apartment, and I couldn't find a pen to write it down, so I wrote it in crayon. I'll never forget. And I just wrote the words internal jiu-jitsu, and I said, I'm going to write this book. And actually, when I sold my martial arts academy, that was my intention to write. And I walked in out of nowhere and told my students, look, I'm selling the school so that I can go write a book. And they were all in shock because, again, it was a sudden decision because I was hypomanic. I didn't, it was like in 5 minutes I decided to sell. And I walked in with my daughter, and they were having a competition at the time, and I was going through my divorce. And you know, and those people loved me. I was with them for 9 years, and I was like a dad to a lot of them, and it broke a lot of their hearts, you know. At the time, I wasn't thinking about that. At the time, I was just thinking, all right, this is what I have to do. This is, it's almost like a calling. So I'm gonna go do it. And I didn't really, I just didn't think about other people's feelings, unfortunately, at the time. I wasn't empathetic to that. Yeah, so the book, I started writing the book, the first book, by hand, and I was scribbling everything so that I couldn't read it, because I just wanted to get the emotion out first and not look back and read what I'd written. So then, as I started writing, I got off my meds, and the book became, instead of a journey about the parallels of jiu-jitsu and life, it became a chronicling of my cycling, of my up and down, my depression and my hypomania. So one day I felt like a prophet, and the next day I felt like, you know, just the biggest piece of trash. And I would write that way. I would say how I was feeling on that day. It's pretty raw, and I don't hold anything back. I probably got way too personal, like for some people in my life. And I don't regret it. It's what I had to say. I actually had to go in after I put it out and take some stuff out because my ex-wife wasn't too happy about some of the stuff I put in there. And I totally saw her point. But when I first started writing it, I was still pissed off about how the marriage ended. So I had to let some of that out. Sorry, there's a fire truck passing. So I had to let the vitriol out at first. And then I did probably 15 drafts where I cut down and I cut down. And as I started to feel better and let go of the anger, there was less and less of that, that venom in the manuscript. So when I finished, it turned out to be a 500-page book, which I wasn't expecting. Yeah, and it was just different from what I first envisioned. But I decided I wanted to still put it out because it was my reality for that time, and I knew that other people were dealing with those mood swings that I was dealing with, and it would resonate with them
So that's
personally.
interesting. You actually wrote it kind of in real time, like real time emotions.
Yeah, I mean, I would think about things from the past, but I would think of them in terms of how I could have been more mindful and more aware of what I was doing, how certain traumatic events shaped what I was going through at the time. There's the fire truck again. Can you guys hear the fire truck?
Not really, no. Can
We
you?
hear the ice cream truck when it goes by.
If we miss the ice cream truck, we're going to be really angry. So,
Man, I just found out that I'm pre-diabetic, so I can't have too many sweets anymore,
oh
which bugged me out
no.
because I barely eat sugar, But when I was bodybuilding, I would pig out like mad, especially after competitions. Like I would gain 30 to 40 pounds in a week after the competition,
Wow.
mostly from water weight. And throughout that, I mean, when I ate dessert, it would be like a whole cake and stuff like that. So I'm sure you guys can relate, right?
Oh, yes.
Why would you
He
say
knows who we are.
that?
We actually share the
So,
cake, split it right in half.
yeah. Now, after my divorce, I would pass out on the couch with a cake on my lap.
Wow.
That was how far I'd
I thought
fallen.
that's how you fall asleep in general.
That's what we call a
People fall
sleeping pill.
asleep.
So was there some, after the book was published, after you published it on Amazon, did you feel a sense of, yeah, liberation, expression, something, was something positive come of it?
Yeah, I mean, it had been such a long journey for that one, from conception to putting it out. And I worked really hard. Like once I got it edited, I worked really hard on fixing it and putting more science in there and more about the technical aspects of the disorders, and their origins and everything, and did a little more studying about the brain and about stress hormones and things like that. I remember I drew a diagram of a brain and I had it taped to my mirror, and along with a bunch of other stuff. And I really delved into researching for the book after the first draft, because I wanted to make it grounded in some factual scientific stuff,
Right.
aside from the personal experience, and I was learning for my own treatment at the time. I really feel like you have to be a partner with your team, with your psychiatrist and with your therapist. You can't just think that they're going to fix you on your own or on their own, or if the med or that the medication alone is going to fix you. You got to learn as much as possible about what's going on inside of you, and not just let your coaches take over and dictate what you should do,
Yeah. And what was the response to your book besides from your ex-wife in general?
It was great to see, people contacting me and saying that it just really spoke to them and that they'd gone through a similar experience and they could really relate. And I talked a lot about being suicidal in the book as well, and so many people have been there. And of course, it's the most rewarding thing when you hear anybody say that you touched them in some way, that you helped them.
Right.
So it was a great satisfaction to hear that, to put it out.
And
Perhaps
go
you'd
ahead.
like to read some of
Wow.
the
Wow.
reader letters about us. I'm sorry, go ahead, excuse me.
No, go
I
ahead,
didn't mean
Lon.
to interrupt you, Ma. Well, no, I was going
We
to make
thought
a
we'd
comment
interrupt each
about
other
when
less when we
people.
were on Zoom, but we're interrupting each
I
other
know we're
more. We're much
much
worse.
worse than per. Yeah. I was going to say, the response, he should hear some of our reader letters about how people just love us in this show.
We've touched them.
We seem to get criticized nonstop from the people who listen. Everything's wrong with us, so we're waiting for that wonderful response like you had.
No.
We're
If you're
definitely not
not
going to get
getting
it today.
if you're not getting some hate, you're not doing something, you're not doing it right. So
Ooh, I like that.
yeah, we need to
yeah.
write that one down. So your next book is called Internal Jiu-Jitsu: How to Conquer Inner and Outer Resistance by Giving Way. And it looks like you have a publisher for this one, and it's coming out in, well, this month.
Yeah, it came out May 8th,
Oh,
actually.
May 8th. Okay.
So,
Congratulations.
thank you, thank you. I'm super excited about it. I'm really happy with it. Unlike the first book, I wrote it because it was percolating for so long. I wrote it like in a week, my first
Wow.
draft. And then my editors kept sending it back, and I would write. So we ended up doing probably six drafts in all. But that first draft just came out, in a few days. I'd never been so locked in writing anything before, And again, I think because I was thinking about it for so long, and I'd lived my life this way for so many years that I just had tons to say about it, and I knew that I'd get the chance to write the book that I wanted to write in the beginning because I was on my medication and I was stable enough yet creative enough at the time. I wasn't at that flat, stable stage yet. So I had the creative juices flowing, but I wasn't losing it on one pole or the other, which was critical. I had a nice balance at the time. And it felt like what I was supposed to be doing, it felt like really right. And I got an amazing publisher, an amazing team of editors. That collaborative experience, I really, really enjoyed. I love working with a team of people. I love doing theater because of that. It's just having a group of people to work with and have fun with, and create art with. Yeah, it's been awesome. It's reminded me of
You do
those theater
theater?
days,
You
actually. I
do
used to,
theater as
yeah.
well? No.
I used to I was bartending and acting. I was doing that whole thing
Yeah.
for years, auditioning and bartending at night and writing screenplays as well. So my before I started teaching martial arts, my plan was to move to LA, pursue my screenwriting career, pursue acting. And then my ex-wife, she was my girlfriend at the time. My parents had already bought me Bon Voyage banners and stuff, and my ex-wife was like, "Listen, why don't you stay, work for a year here, save some money, and then go?" And of course, whenever you do that, you end up never going, right? So I got this job teaching, and after 3 years doing that job, my ex-wife was like, "Listen, why don't you open your own academy here?" And I was like, "Well, because I don't want to stay here. I want to move, And she was like, "But this is the perfect place to open a school." And she wore me down. And we drove by a place that was available or that had a sign on it. Then it turned out they were in contract. So I was like, "Look, it's not meant to be." And then my ex-wife kept saying, "Check again, call them again, keep calling, see if it fell through, see if it fell through." But I did reluctantly, and then finally it did fall through, and I ended up getting the space, and it was the perfect space for a school, and we were successful right out of the gate, right from the first month. We built a family there. It was really, I had lots of students like get together there, and some of them got married and had kids, and so it really was a family kind of an atmosphere, but it was taking so much of my time having my own business that when I'd get home and write, it was causing friction with my ex-wife because I'd get home from work at 9 o'clock, then I'd write until 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning, and I barely had time to hang out with her, so the frustration of that made me put screenwriting aside, as much as I loved it. And acting, I got so sick of looking for approval, man. I got so tired of that. And I remember I got a meeting with this great agency, Abrams Artists in New York, and I walk in, and the guy, the agent says, "You don't look like you want to be here." And I said to him, "Well, to be honest with you, all these meetings, I feel like I'm looking for approval from my dad, and I'm kind of tired of it, And he was like, "Well, thank you for your honesty." And then the next day, I was like, "What the hell did I do?" And I wrote him an email. I wrote him an email saying, "Look, I was on cold medication. I wasn't thinking clearly. I'm sorry. I messed up." But I didn't get that agent, obviously. So yeah, I shot myself in the foot a couple times, but that ended acting for me, and that put writing to the side for a little while. And then when I sold the school in 2018, that's when I knew I wanted to get back to writing every day. And it took a few months because I was in that party mood after my divorce, you know. I thought that I would party myself into happiness, and that didn't work out too well. And, you know, 6 months later, I was more depressed than ever. So it didn't work out the way that I thought it would. But then, you know, I wasn't medicated properly. You know, I was feeling so good that I thought, well, I don't need my medication anymore because I just feel amazing. But that's how you feel when you're hypomanic. You feel amazing. And that makes you think you don't need the meds anymore. And that's when you end up crashing into the wall. And then you have to start your meds again and start the whole process over again. So it's very, very dangerous to get off your medication on your own, you know. And I didn't know that before. So you know, the books talk about all that stuff with the meds. I'm super open about everything that I've been through and all the feelings and all the, you know, and the medication that I'm on. And even though there's a stigma about meds for a lot of people, they're life-saving, you know. As many people as, I mean, people do abuse the drugs, obviously. But if you need them, you know you need them when you take them because you don't feel strange or high or any of that stuff. Like when I hear about people taking ADHD medication and staying up all night, like writing papers or whatever, I don't get that effect from it. You know, I just get some clarity. I'm not up all night and I'm not, you know, I'm not pulling all-nighters. But when I'm hypomanic, I do stay up quite late, just researching everything I can research. Like you get interested in everything when you're hypomanic, you know? So you want to know everything about everything. And I got to the point where I was studying so much that I decided to create this multidisciplinary presentation that was it was about trauma and the hero's journey, and how science and religion and psychology all intersect. And it was like a 45-minute PowerPoint that I did with video. And it took me months to do, but I was hypomanic, so I just thought, and I quit two jobs to do it. I was That's another thing. The hypomania will make you quit a job like at the drop of a hat. So I would walk out of jobs and not have anything to replace my income, you know. And when I decided to do this project, I quit two jobs and I told my boss, "Look, I have a calling from God to do this and I have to do it." And of course I got weird looks. But I'm glad I did it, even though it was kind of kooky. I believed everything I was saying at the time. And I do think it was interesting stuff, especially if you're open-minded, you know. But I still threw it up on my YouTube channel, and I said that, look, I'm bipolar and I was hypomanic at this time, and this is the stuff that comes out when you're hypomanic, you know, because I wanted people to see what kind of stuff you create when your mind is there.
Do you want to direct people to your YouTube channel? You want to tell
Yeah,
people how
it's
to find you?
the YouTube channel is Internal Jiu-Jitsu. Pretty much everything is Internal Jiu-Jitsu, Instagram and Facebook and TikTok, and my website is internaljiu-jitsu.com. Yeah, so Internal Jiu-Jitsu, you type that in, I'm going to come up.
And I'll put that on the show description to
Cool.
all your links. Can you explain a few things about your book title, the second book? Because as you've probably figured out, you're not working with the brightest bulbs in the Christmas tree here, the two of us. We don't know exactly what jiu-jitsu is. We don't necessarily know what inner and outer resistance means or what giving way means. Would you be able to
Sure.
enlighten us a little bit?
Yeah, jiu-jitsu is the gentle art. That's what it translates to. It was the fighting system of the samurai when they didn't have their weapons. So it relies on joint locks and strangulations, and throws, like judo throws, originally came from jiu-jitsu. And there's some striking as well in traditional jiu-jitsu. So So I got my black belts in traditional Japanese jiu-jitsu first, and then in judo, which is an evolution of jiu-jitsu, and then in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which is an evolution from judo. So I got the three black belts to kind of get a full understanding of what jiu-jitsu is. And jiu-jitsu deals with leverage, and for the smaller person to be able to defeat a bigger person, for the trained person to be able to defeat the untrained person. Someone who's been doing jiu-jitsu for 6 months will wipe the floor with someone who's never done jiu-jitsu, even if that person is a good boxer or whatever it may be. So giving way is, in jiu-jitsu, you don't want to go, if you're pushing me, I don't just want to push you back, because then we're at a stalemate. I want to allow you to push me just enough so that you think you're succeeding, and then I take you in that direction the way I want to. So I allow you to go where you want to go, but I steer you so that it's beneficial to me. So, for example, if you think you're going to be able to throw me, I may switch my hip position, step in a certain direction, and now you're the one flying through the air because you've overcommitted to what you're doing. In letting that person think they're getting what they want, you actually get what you want.
That's the way we got
So,
out of things without even knowing it when we were kids. Seriously,
yeah.
whether dealing with our insane grandmother, our alcoholic father, the kids in school who bullied us, we always kind of did that on our own, right?
I guess you
Yeah,
did.
yeah.
Let them think they were, getting the control of the situation, and then we use their, being off guard and
Yeah.
took off and saved ourselves. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's all about
Huh.
using your opponent's energy to be able to
Yeah.
defeat them, you know. And resistance you get from in life, internal resistance, especially when we stop ourselves from doing things, when fear holds us back, when there's a roadblock in our way, and rather than trying to figure out how to go around it or how to get over it, we kind of allow it to stop us. And in jiu-jitsu, when you're met with an obstacle, you find a way around that obstacle. You don't acquiesce to something that seems unmovable, you cause the movement, you create the movement so that you get the result that you want, and then there's I can give you the slightest little push and get the reaction that I want from you. Like if I give you a slight little push, you're going to try to defend by making your weight go forward. And when you try to make your weight go forward, I throw you forward. So that's the idea behind jiu-jitsu, right? You've got to keep your balance if I shove you backwards. And this is a game I play with my students. You give a little shove twice, and the person will kind of stiffen up to so they don't move back. And then the third time, you pretend you're pushing them, and they still step forward to defend themselves, like to be able to be stiff. But now they've come forward to you because they anticipated that push, right? So you fake them and you faint them out, and you make them think you're going to do something, and you do the opposite instead. And sometimes we just have to outsmart the obstacles that are in front of us, or we have to allow them to guide us in a new direction. And it's kind of like a pinball machine, you hit that pinball and it's gonna bounce off one thing and go to another. And if you use those little barriers to help you bounce to the next thing, then all of a sudden they're not obstacles. Now they're assisting you, right? The very resistance that they're giving you will help you kind of, will help steer you in the direction that is going to be easier and more beneficial for you.
So can you give us an example
One
of that, like a real life example of the internal jiu-jitsu working for you?
of the best examples is when someone gets aggressive with you. I
Okay.
teach these workshops, and I talk a lot about being aware of other people's triggers and de-escalating situations. So if someone begins to get loud with you and aggressive, if you try to match that aggression, it's just going to escalate the situation, right? But
Right.
if you at least make them think that they're being heard, and that not necessarily that they're right, but that they're being heard, and you're not getting defensive with them, Now all of a sudden their level of aggression goes down and they get calmer and they feel like, okay, I'm getting my way because this person is listening. But actually, I've gotten my way because I've de-escalated the situation.
Can I ask a stupid question? Because that's really all I have.
That's all we have.
Two jiu-jitsu masters are going to have a match, and they're one's here, one's here. Do they just, I pictured based on the philosophy you're telling me, they could stand facing each other forever, waiting for the other one to make the first move, right?
That's
I mean,
interesting.
how.
Well, without movement, nothing happens. When you see when you see people using chi, like to push someone down or any of that nonsense, that's a bunch of bullshit. That stuff isn't real. In order for martial arts to work, you have to pressure test the martial art. And that's one of the great things about jiu-jitsu. Like I said, we spar every day and it's with full on, using all your strength. And the only way to win a match is to engage and to transition from one move to another in order to get to an advantageous position to defeat your opponent. So if you're just standing there, nothing's going to happen, in some matches, one guy will just sit down and wait for the other guy to come in and engage, because most of it's done on the ground. You take the person to the ground and then you continue to fight on the ground. So sometimes both guys end up sitting down because they both want to play off their back, which I hate. But so they do that, which makes it really impractical for self-defense. Obviously, you're not going to be in a self-defense situation out in the street and sit down. It's kind of ridiculous. And that's one of the things I hate about turning martial arts into sports. They water it down so much. It turns into something completely different. And I love the sport aspect of it, like for when I do it and when I watch it. But as a self-defense instructor, it makes me cringe sometimes,
So jiu-jitsu is more than just physical. It's really a battle of the minds and of intuition, right? I
Yeah,
guess.
it's called human chess because you have to both be very, very in the moment, but you have to think many, many steps ahead to get to where you want. You have to think, okay, when I do this, when I push him this way, he's going to push me back this way. And that's when I'll go in this direction. Or if I grab him here, he's going to pull away from me. So then I'll do this, and then he'll do this, and then I'll do that. So it's the perfect combination of thinking and not thinking.
I think it's, I'm kind of fascinated by the parallel to actual, to human behavior and interaction as far as conflict, because the easiest thing, as you said, was to just tear at each other. But the person who's doing the internal jiu-jitsu is actually, sort of navigating, right? Is sort of planning, what move to make in order to, perhaps de-escalate, to avoid an ugly outcome of this.
And when you see a good jiu-jitsu athlete train, you can see that in their face. I mean, there's an incredible calm that you appear to have when you're training, even when you're going full blast, especially when you're a black belt. You just look super relaxed when you're doing it, which tends to kind of freak your opponent out even more because they think you're not putting any effort into it. You are. You're just also calm enough so that you can think about where to go next, and you're using minimal energy. You're trying to use the least amount of energy and make your partner supply most of the energy for you by pushing you too hard or pulling you too hard and overcommitting to their technique.
Interesting. La, does this any of this sound familiar to you? All those times you screamed at people on the set and got thrown off because you
Well,
didn't know
like
how to
all of this is like
de-escalate?
de-escalating. Yes, all this is
You were
we're
like the
kind of doing
master
a
of
lot of this stuff.
escalating.
Well, yes, and then I de-escalate and what is it, gaslight, and but a lot of
No,
this makes sense though
you don't
without me.
de-escalate. You wait till the room is blown up and then.
But a lot of the stuff that you've been talking about is stuff that we inherently did to survive. Like we're not going to bore you with all the details, but one of the things like we learn to do, we call it the La cry.
It's
We do
called
this
the captive,
horrible
cry.
captive cry, which they'd start to attack us, and whether it was our parents or kids in the street, and we just learned to do this ear shattering like that, and they'd just leave us alone. And in a way, we were
Eventually.
manipulating them. We knew it would.
Everyone goes in with a game plan, right? I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and then. But the problem is, you have an opponent who also has a game plan. So if your initial game plan doesn't work, you have to move to the next thing, and you have to again be in the moment and see what your partner's giving you. The first step, though, is to get a grip on your partner. You have to get a hold of them first. So both practitioners will try to grip each other's. If you're wearing a kimono, you try to grip the kimono. If you're not, then you just try to grip the person's body. You can train, you can compete with a kimono or without. So it's about getting that first grip, that contact. And that contact is going to really dictate how the match goes, because you can't feel the direction your partner's going in if you're not connected to them physically, right? Just the same way that if you're not connected to the things around you and the people around you, you're not really going to know what direction to take. Sometimes you won't know what doors are open for you. You're kind of riding it out alone, you know, and you can't play jiu-jitsu alone. You need someone to react off of, you know. You need to not react, but respond. And that's what your opponent provides for you, and that's what life provides for you. Life becomes, you know, all our partners in jiu-jitsu are our friends, because they're helping us get better. You know, at the end of the match, we always shake hands and thank each other, because we're sharpening each other as athletes and as martial artists. So we're very appreciative of our partners. And they have our lives in their hands. I mean, they could choke us unconscious, and you know, they could technically, they could kill us in training, and they don't. Our life is in their hands. So that creates a real tight bond between you and your partners. And again, that connection is essential, you know, and it brings two people together in a way that few things do. You know, fighting is a very spiritual experience. You know, you connect with your opponent. You almost become one in a lot of ways, you know, because you're going back and forth in this tit and tat, and you're trying to one up each other. But you're using all your skills, and you're using all the dedication that you've put in, and you have to, again, you have to be in tune with each other in order to get the best out of your own performance.
And just to make sure that I'm understanding this, you're speaking about the actual martial art of jiu-jitsu, but you're also speaking metaphorically about applying it to dealing, at least, with mental illness in day-to-day
Yeah.
interactions with people.
Right. You know, I talk about depression, and I talk about it like you're being smothered by an opponent, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
When you're on the bottom in jiu-jitsu, sometimes it can be an advantageous position if you know how to use what's called your guard. That's when you're playing off your back. But sometimes when your partner gets a good position on you on the ground, and you're pinned and you can barely breathe, you know, and you're taking these really short breaths, it's very much like you're either depressed or dealing with anxiety, and you've got this kind of crushing feeling, and you want to give up. And you push through, and you push through, and you make it out the other end, you know, much like when you're depressed. But at the
Okay.
time, it feels like you're stuck forever, you know. And when you can't move, when there's no movement, there's no progress.
Okay.
So in jiu-jitsu, when a match stalls, and there's no progress, it becomes very boring. And in depression, your life stalls, and now all of a sudden you're stuck in this rut, and there's no movement, there's no transition, so there's no change. And you just feel like you're suffocating, you know.
Okay.
And in jiu-jitsu, it takes just the slightest movement. It's a game of inches. So if you might move your hip a little bit to one side, and that'll give you an escape, you know. But when you're not thinking rationally and you can't be in the moment, then you're not going to remember, oh, I just need to move my hip this way, you know. Or
Gotcha.
I hey, if I'm depressed, I just need to get up and take a shower and, maybe go out for a walk and I'm going to
Right.
feel better. So there are all these little things you can do that you can't think about when you're depressed or when you're super anxious. But there's always something you can do, whether it's talk to someone or journal or go take a yoga class or whatever it may be. There's something you can do to make you feel better, but at the time, it just feels so all-encompassing that those thoughts don't enter your mind. You just feel like it's hopeless. And in a match, you can feel like it's hopeless sometimes. Even me as a black belt, sometimes I'll get into a match where I feel like, man, I'm just in a really bad position. This whole
Huh.
match is going to go bad. Yeah, it
Interesting.
happens, And I can live with it a lot better now than I used to. I used to let that stuff really get to me and crush me. But now again, I realize sometimes you have to surrender, and that's okay.
Well,
That's a perfect segue to pushing to plugging your second book again, because that's a really nice
yeah.
way to explain how how you're tying the two things together, the mental recovering from mental illness and jiu-jitsu. Was pretty
Yeah,
profound,
they've always
actually. That was very profound. It made me cry.
Yeah, we haven't pronounced it
And
right once, have we? But we do get the
I'm
concept. I
not a
mean,
crier. Was very nice.
yeah,
Because
thank
we
you.
sat for 15 years. 15 years we lived, La in the attic, me in the basement. We barely even seeing each other or talking to each other. We felt we were crushed by depression and failure. And we just, it's only the last 2 years that we started to come up from that. And if only you had had your book to show us that you just moved your hip a little to the left out of the potato chips, maybe some new life can come in. This is a, look at that book. We want people to read it and get out of that mess.
Yeah, so do I. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm really proud of it. I'm really happy with it. We got some really great reviews from our early readers. So,
Excellent.
I know I did what I set out to do with this book. And I wanted it to be, something easily digestible, not a 500 word book like I wrote before. It's about 150 pages, the new one. It's something you can read in one day if you really want to sit down and
Okay.
dive in. And it's about the side. There's this book called The War of Art that I'm a huge fan of, and another book called The Book of Five Rings that was written by a samurai. And they're small, short books, but there's so much packed in them, and those were my inspiration for this. I wanted to combine The War of Art with The Book of Five Rings. I wouldn't be arrogant enough to say that I pulled it off, but I'm really happy with what I did.
We better wrap things up for the evening. For our listeners, we will put all this information in our episode description. Julio Rivera's new book is called Internal Jiu-Jitsu: How to Conquer Inner and Outer Resistance by Giving Way. Thank you so much. Thank you 1,000 times for your
Oh, my
patience with us
pleasure.
and for being here today. Just for being here today. We've had two really, really smart guests in a row now. And it brings us up, we're not. Well, it does a little bit, La. I mean, we're a
We
little
may need a
smarter than you,
crane. I
on the
really
side
appreciate
jokes.
you guys.
Anything else, La, before
But
we
wait,
sign
do we
off?
do wait, do we do we before we go, do we have a listener email or anything? Any listener
Yeah, I
emails?
just sent it to you. We had one that was intelligible anyway. Do you want to read it? Did
Okay.
you get it?
Dear Lob, this is what we mean. This is our listeners. Dear Law Brothers, have you tried Ozempic? That's it.
Unless we can find it on the street with the other
Yeah,
needles, I don't
we have
think
no
we're gonna.
health
We have
insurance.
no health insurance, so anyway,
Well,
write to us, halfalivepodcast@gmail.com and facebook.com, halfalivepodcast. That's it for episode two, season three of Half Alive with the Law Brothers. Thank you, listeners, for listening. You are the reason we endure this cruel world.
had an easy Mac.
Thanks so much, Julio. Bye, Law.
Thanks, guys.